This is Neil Rockine. Welcome to another edition of Killer Cross-Examination, the podcast where we talk to some of the top trial lawyers in the country about their practices, their habits, their styles, their approaches. This week's episode is no different. Joseph Neuberger, this is the Killer Cross-Examination podcast, Canadian style. So yes, there are amazing lawyers outside of the United States, and I've got one of Toronto and one of Ontario's best. Joseph Neuberger is here. Joseph, I don't know if you go by Joe or Joseph, but I am thrilled to have you here on the Killer Cross-Examination podcast.
I'm thrilled to be on your podcast. You can call me whatever you like. So call me Joe, as long as you don't call me what my ex-wife calls me.
Okay. I don't know what that is, but it doesn't sound like it's very flattering.
It's not nice.
So tell me, I usually start with, I like to jump right into things, but I always feel like it's best for us to just spend a little bit of time talking about your background. So tell me about your background, how you get into law and how you get into criminal defense.
So, you know, uniquely, when I was a young student, I was always interested in law. And for some reason, I was interested in criminal law. And I got lucky when I went to law school, because in Ontario, we have one of our law schools, which is Osgoode Hall. We have a program that's still active till today, because I was called to the bar back in 1993. So I'm a bit of a dinosaur. But we have they had a program which still continues, which is a program that allows you to work for 6 months with a judge, a prosecutor, or a defense lawyer. And I worked with a guy named John Rosen, who used to be known as Mr. Murder in Ontario. He did more homicide cases than any other defense lawyer. And I was with him in second year, and I sat on these murder cases with him, and I just fell in love. I fell in love with the whole practice and, you know, the thrill of jury trials and cross-examination. And it just, you know, and the intellectual aspect of taking a problem and trying to deal with it and dissect the evidence, it really appealed to me. So I was sold at that point, and I finished my law school, articled, and I became a criminal lawyer.
So tell me what you're in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Correct. Tell me about the legal system in Ontario and in Canada. Is it different than it is here in the United States, and to what degree?
Yeah, so we're relatively similar. So in the United States, you have, you know, a lot of state statutes with respect to criminal laws. We have a federal system. So we have one statute across Canada, which is called our criminal code. And we all have the same legislation to abide by. So, you know, it's all set out there. And then we have case law based upon what the Courts of Appeal and Supreme Court of Canada says. Very similar to what you'll have in your courts of appeal and then your Supreme Court. So our laws are very similar. You have, ours is a little more streamlined in a sense. So you can have certain cases, like when I do sexual assault cases, you have different variants of it. We just call it sex assault, and it can be anything from a touch to a full on, you know, rape. But it's all very similar because we're based on the same common law system that originated back in, you know, in England. So it's all very, very similar.
So do you have any of the same terms or terminology as the English legal system with like barristers and
Yeah, we're referred to as barristers, but we are barristers and solicitors. So unlike the UK, where you're educated just as a barrister and or a solicitor, we are graduated as barristers and solicitors, so we can do whatever work we choose. So if we want to be a real estate lawyer, or we want to be a litigator, we can. So just like you, when you graduate from a law school in the United States, you can practice all areas of law. So we're very similar in that respect. Our law societies are very similar with respect to our governance. And the only thing which is a bit different is in the United States, you are much better at jury trials, in the sense that your jurisdictions have protected the concept of a jury trial as a unique perspective of democracy. Whereas in Canada, we have it for more serious offenses. So offenses that are punishable by 2 years less a day are generally done judge alone, as you would call a bench trial. And those that are more serious, you can elect to have a jury trial. But in Canada, there's a real push to try and limit jury trials. And I'm not thankful for that. I'm actually quite against it. And in the United States, you have a very robust process for jury selection. We have pick your first fucking 12, and that's what it is. It's awful. It's awful. Our government, our prime minister, who I am no fan of, a few years ago, decided to eliminate challenges. We got these things called peremptory challenges, where I can just eliminate a potential juror because, you know, as lawyers, we get a feel, right? You look at somebody, you know, whether they're going to be interested or whether they're going to be good for you to have on a panel. We could just say challenge without explaining why. So those were called peremptory challenges. They've only been in place for several hundred years. And our prime minister, with his then Minister of Justice, got rid of all that because of some case in one of our provinces, which was just an abomination. So now it's a joke in Canada. So, you know, some judges are fantastic. They give us much more involvement in picking a jury. And some judges say, no, you don't get any input whatsoever. And we could get the first 12 that did come up. So I love the United States and your robust approach to juries and to how you do jury selection. It is really far better than what we have in Canada. And I think jury trials are extremely important.
What's the strategy then in selecting or electing to have a jury trial in your legal system versus what we'll just call a bench trial?
So that's an excellent question. So I'm not, you know, when you have your typical murder case or whatever, you got to go jury. But sometimes there are certain things that you may believe that would resonate more with the common, you know, community member than it would with a judge. And you can relate to their emotions and to their understanding of right and wrong that a judge wouldn't understand. And that's really the incentive to go before a jury. But I have to say, in Canada, given my practice, we have a lot of judges who are very astute at protecting the right to, beyond a reasonable doubt, that you don't get convicted unless there's that threshold. And in the bench trials or the judge alone trials, I typically, if I do that, I do written submissions. So at the end of the day, instead of standing in front of a jury and talking to them, I do these extensive written submissions and I get acquittals. But juries have sometimes a really good sense of what doesn't make sense, what doesn't smell right. And when I have a case where I think it's on the edge, I may want a jury. And I know that they won't like the complainant or they won't like these witnesses. And I can work with an emotive aspect. And I think juries react to that very well.
So it's not too dissimilar here, although, I mean, I prefer jury trials almost uniformly over bench trials. Bench trials here, though, you know, judge decided trials, there are strategically reasons to have them, particularly if there are going to be some really gnarly facts, some facts that are just going to be very difficult
right.
to get to for jurors to process and then to put aside to decide what is like a legal issue. So, for example, if I were to say in Michigan, the statute of limitations is not a fact defense that you would raise at trial. Entrapment is not a fact defense that you would raise at trial. Those right. are legal defenses that you would have to raise to a jury. But if they were legal, if they were factual defenses, a defense saying that, yeah, my client may have done it, very likely did this horrible thing, but they charged them a day late and they're a dollar short. That wouldn't necessarily have a lot of jury appeal. I could imagine right. a jury trying to find every way possible to go on the other side. Say, no, they got them just in time. You know what I mean?
Right.
Just a day on a day before the deadline or some tolling argument. And so there are arguments for that. There are reasons. And there are some very well-known acquittals here where very astute lawyers have recognized that it's better to have a judge trial than to have a jury trial. But those cases I think are rare. They're rare.
So I had a recent case, which was a human trafficking case. So that's a case where as we call it, human trafficking. It's where my client was allegedly this essentially a pimp who was trafficking out this young lady who was brought in from a northern part of Ontario, and in front of a jury would not have gone well. The jury would have just hated the facts, that, you know, and looked at my client like a, you know, they would have just not liked it. But I had a technical legal argument, and I had serious issues with respect to credibility of one witness who was a former accused and turned to cooperate with the prosecution. So I was able to get a lot of hay with the judge and structure it in a way that he had no choice but to acquit. In front of a jury, I'm sure he would have been convicted.
Interesting. And I think that's some of the strategies. So we're talking about a lot of the same thing, which is where you just, there are just cases that are, does the government have the right to insist upon a jury trial in Canada?
That's a very good question. Only in homicides. So
okay.
If it is a homicide, then it's automatically jury. You have to ask for permission from the Attorney General in Canada if we can do judge alone. And sometimes you may want to do that. It's rare, but it happens. Other than that, we get the selection.
Interesting. Here, by comparison, it used to be, we always think of it's the defendant's right, the accused right to have a trial by jury. And that makes perfect sense, of course.
Yes.
But over time, as the apparatus sort of got a hold of the legal system, you now have a right to a trial by judge or jury, but you only have a right to a trial by judge if both the prosecutor and the court agree to a judge trial.
Interesting.
So there are some judges that have been that are more compassionate, understanding, willing to hold the state to a higher burden, not a higher legal burden but they won't water the burden down. They right. don't look at it like it's a evidentiary hearing or a preliminary examination. They really hold the state to a high burden. They're not, and those judges are ones that it's very difficult to get a judge trial in front of, because you know, the prosecutor looks and is like, no, we're not going to agree. We're just not going to agree. And they've been given the right to throw a hissy fit if we insist upon a judge trial or a bench trial with them. And some judges don't want it. Some judges just politically, they prefer the cover of letting the jury decide. They don't want to have to make the call themselves.
Yeah. So, you know, I have a question for you, you know, so that's a great issue. You know, in Canada, we fought very hard to keep judges independent and to not screw up the appointment process so that it's partisan and political. And we've been successful at that up till now. I'm not sure what's going to happen with, you know, if we have a change in government, but we've been good at that. And judges are not frightened about making decisions that are unpopular. I have to say, I have been very proud of our judiciary over the last few years, where they are making decisions that are not popular. In the United States, you know, you have judges at lower levels that I guess are elected. And then given their appointments, those that are appointed, they may be, you know, worried about their independence. That's a tough thing to deal with. Like in Canada, we have, you know, in Canada, I have the choice, not the prosecutor.
In state, so federal court judges are appointed and they have a lifetime appointment. So the United States has become a very bad trait, very bad trend, which is to label judges as appointed by, you know, a Trump appointed judge or a Biden appointed judge. It's a very bad trend because it just so happens that the judge is essentially, you know, broomed out all of their wisdom and experience and ends up getting broomed out by essentially half of the country when they get labeled as a Biden or an Obama or a Trump appointed judge. In state court, judges are elected, they're independent, but you know whether they're red or blue, whether they
right.
I mean, and you know
they want to be reelected, right?
And they want to be 6 years. Yeah. And so they want to be reelected. Very few have lost reelection, but there's there's a general view now because everybody is a writer. Everybody's a journalist. You know, we've got expert everything now. All it takes is a phone or a keyboard to be an expert at something, as I'm sure you know. And so judges nowadays, and we had situations where judges were followed to lunch and they were, you know, spotted here or there, or they were observed at a, you know, did they pick up the check or did they? And so judges ended up, you know, there's also this issue. Are they going to be the subject of negative campaigning, of a negative PR campaign? You'd like to think that they don't care, but they're human. And I think they do care. And some care a great deal. So I'm thrilled that we have a jury trial system here. It's really, I think, a cornerstone. I believe that it's an example of daily democracy. I gave a TED talk where I talked about the joy of the jury and incredible diversity that jury trials bring, and which is why I'm so, you know, if you told me tomorrow that I wasn't able to try jury cases, I would want to take a real hard look at what judges I had to try the cases in front of.
Yeah, and I agree with you because, you know, when you look at a jury system, to me, it's the crucible of democracy. This is our democratic process at its core. You know, 12 people deciding the fate of their fellow citizen about guilt or innocence, that is our democracy here, where you get people from the community. So I absolutely agree with you.
And it's daily democracy.
That's so protected.
It's daily democracy.
And you real democracy.
The CEO of the largest corporation, if he's somehow able to not get out of jury service or wants to serve, he has no more of a vote on a 12-person or 6-person jury than does the 18-year-old college student who's still living in, you know, the basement of with his or her parents. They have the same vote. That's true democracy, where there's no wealth or privilege in the jury room. You literally, it's who is, you know. So I love that aspect of it. So let me ask you this. So what kind of cases do you primarily handle? And when I mean primarily handle, I know you're a criminal defense lawyer, but as you know, we criminal defense lawyers tend to either we have chosen a particular subset of cases that we handle, or the market, the public has in a way chosen that subset for us. So tell me about your practice and how you got to it.
So about 20 years ago, I got chosen by the marketplace to do mostly domestic and sexual assault cases. And then as time went on, I drew in men and some women who felt they were falsely accused of domestic or sexual assault related offenses, some arising out of what I call high conflict divorces. And so the market chose me, and that's where my practice went. And then somebody joined me who is a former journalist who has a non-for-profit organization for wrongfully accused men and women. And we joined forces to sort of work on this area. So my niche practice really has focused now, I'm in year 31, on these sort of wrongful accusations in sexual and domestic cases.
How important is cross-examination and how important is that in your practice?
Vital. That is the absolute most important instrument of trying to seek the truth. That is the most important aspect of what we do. It takes so much time to craft your cross-examination. And in Canada, we have these rules now with respect to what materials we can cross-examine a complainant on. So I have to bring these applications to ask a judge for permission to cross-examine on emails or messages or other documents. I have to beg for that. So you have to be very calculated in your cross-examination, and it's vital.
Do you get unlimited time? Do judges shut you down?
No.
Are there rules of evidence that the opposing side can object to? I mean, they object to your questions as it's happening, or is it legally take place before you begin the process?
So those are good questions. So let me talk about sexual assault because it's a very unique area.
Okay.
So again, our wonderful Prime Minister, after a high profile case in Canada, decided to change the laws of sexual assault because he didn't like the verdict. And he put into place new legislation that said any records that are in the possession of the accused have to be vetted before a judge before you can cross-examine on it. And of course, there's all these what we call rape myth issues. So all of that has to be vetted before a judge. So we bring these applications. My applications are 40 to 60 pages long. We disclose everything, including our defense. So that gets vetted. But we're not at the stage where some lawyers for our prosecution, as we call them, Crown attorneys, and the complainant in Canada gets their own lawyer on these motions, have tried to say they should vet our cross-examination. Thank God that hasn't happened, and we've won our applications, and most of this has not been to our detriment because the complainant doesn't get all of our material. But once we vet that, and because my applications are so detailed, I have zero opposition to my cross-examination. It's rare, and I'm lucky now. You know, year 31, most people don't bother to try and challenge me. But because we have this vetting process, cross-examination usually goes on without difficulty. And it is extensive. It can go on for hours or days. And as you know, as a criminal lawyer, you ask a question only because you know what the answer is going to be, and there has to be a purpose to that question. So I don't try and belabor it. You know, my longest cross-examination, I think, in my career was like 2 days. You know, so I try and be very surgical in what I do.
Are there a lot of dramatics in your, are there gotcha moments, dramatics, that kind of thing in the type of cases you handle and the witnesses you cross-examine? If so, kind of give me an example of think of one.
You know, depending upon whether you're in front of a judge or a jury, but sometimes, you know, like a judge can fall asleep, right? Same with a jury. You got to have dramatics. They want to have a show. Let's be honest. Okay.
Yes.
So, you know, I had a case recently where I had a high conflict divorce. It was a sex assault, 2 counts. And I brought expert evidence that my client was an abused husband, which is a first in Canada. Right. I won. But what was like the most juiciest thing was I got this settlement agreement in the family court where the complainant had to return all these things she literally stole from my client. And when I set her up for this, I slowly took her through this sort of list and what she was doing. And I had so much fun with it. And because I had some emails from her where she was critiquing my client saying, "How dare you do this? You think you're so entitled that you're able to just take my keys, you're just able to take the car without asking for permission." And she had taken everything from my client. She had taken immigration documents, all his banking documents. She took his degree from the University of Toronto off the wall, okay? So you can imagine when I got through the family lawyer this settlement agreement that said that she has to return this stuff, and I don't know whether she forgot about it or not, I was like over the moon. And so I paused on everything, and it was so much fun.
How are you seeing? So you've used the term high conflict divorce a couple of times. Tell me, so I know that there are high conflict divorces, and then there are, you know, like sort of easy no contest divorces. Yeah. When you're describing a high conflict divorce, are you talking about where there are major allegations going both ways? There's a lot of money at stake. There's custody, child support. I mean, you're talking about lawyers are really digging in and trying to yeah. just.
Yeah, so, our family court system's broken. Mm. So, you know, it's a disaster. So, you know, when there's money and issues and children, you know, people will do all sorts of shit. And so a lot of the cases I see are where there is a challenge that, you know, one parent wants to alienate the other. They want maximum spousal support and child support. They want an equal distribution of assets because they've been abused. And now we have in Canada, you don't have, you know, in the family law system, you can actually sue for damages for domestic violence. All that breeds this high conflict.
Wait, divorce. so it's a divorce case over a division of assets and of custody and property, but it's also you can actually get like you can wrap up an assault, domestic violence assault in our system is a tort, so you can of course. You can make an allegation.
Use that term.
Yeah.
So there was one judge who said there was a tort of domestic violence. Our Supreme Court of Canada just said, look, no, we're not creating that tort, but you can consider that and apportion money and compensation if there has been a history of abuse in the relationship. Wow. And they consider something called coercive control, which is not physical violence, but controlling, you know, let's say, because it does happen. One spouse or the other controls the banking and everything else. So if you can establish coercive control, that can lead to also damages or an unequal distribution or a higher payout with respect to support. So all that's at play in family court. That fucking then spills over to the criminal court process where I get to deal with these allegations because, oh my God, it's so amazing.
I know those things happen. And I know those things happen, but to actually...
Oh, they happen.
To make them... To make them, that's so foreign to me, to make them actually like the compensable because you incentivize, and we're going to get into it now, which is this controversy that I know you've been embroiled in a little bit online, which is you have incentivized people to make allegations about the other. For everybody that's going to get all freaked out about this. Look, everyone, and people that are all whipped up over this and they're all, you know, excited or excitable about this subject. Look, the fact of the matter is that the most significant family law assault battered spouse case that we saw that caught everybody's attention recently was the Amber Heard Johnny Depp case, which was a defamation case.
Right.
But let's not kid ourselves. Yes, it was a defamation case and it was about defamation and libel. But at the root of it was, did you believe that she was the one that was abusive towards him? Or did you believe that he was the one that was abusive towards her? That really what it came down to. Right. I mean,
I actually followed it and commented in the media. And that's a perfect example.
So, okay. I cut you off and you were just getting revved up. Your arm was resting on the edge of your chair, ready to leap through the. So tell me it happens and tell me about it. Tell me about these cases.
Right. It incentivizes people, you know? So, you know, the presumption should always be, let's talk about children first, that it should be shared custody. Okay. But that's not the case. People withhold children. Okay. Whether they're male or female, you don't get access. And then the best way to do it is to allege, oh, I was sexually assaulted in 2013. He was drunk and he didn't ask for permission and he had his way. And he's been yelling at the kid. And this stuff happens. And then you get the charges. And so it incentivizes the whole process because you can see that you might get a higher spousal support or child support, or then even some damages in the family court proceeding. And I have seen this consistently. This is my practice where there are, you know, separations, and then there are letters exchanged between lawyers. And then after that, when somebody doesn't capitulate, boom, you got criminal charges. Oh my God, after our honeymoon, he sexually assaulted. That's literally one of the cases I dealt with recently. After my honeymoon, he sexually assaulted. And the whole impetus was because the complainant in that case really wanted access to the $1 million that was in the account.
Now, I read recently that you were, and I saw it sort of play out. So I saw this play out on social media where you had just won a trial.
Yeah.
And we're talking about false allegations. And I don't remember your quote, but it had something to do. I'm sure you remember it because it seems like for 4 or 5 days, you have been, maybe longer, you have been responding or have been sort of the subject of some online, and talking about. And so you and I, before we went on the air, we talked a little bit about that. And you have what you believe is a really unique perspective because of the type of practice you have and the type of records that you've seen. So walk me through that.
Okay. So thank you very much for addressing this. So, every so often I make a I really don't make a lot of posts on Twitter or X or whatever you call it, but you know, I'm sometimes on it, and we had a long case, and I think my quote was, you know, we always have to be vigilant about ensuring and challenging the narrative that false allegations are not rare, because in Canada, and I believe across the globe, there is a serious push by certain interest groups to say that a sexual assault allegation is always truthful, okay? And that a false allegation is rare. It's not rare. So in my practice, given the fact that men come to us, and some women, where they are falsely accused, we see a disproportionate amount where it's false. I think we're roaming around somewhere around what I see about 70% in my practice. But you know, in the grand scale of things, I agree, and I've said it very clearly on social media, that there's a high majority of legitimate sexual assault allegations. We do not in any way refute that. That's absolutely true. That said, to try and suggest that all sexual assault allegations are truthful, or that a false accusation is rare, is like saying that the earth doesn't rotate around the sun. It's bullshit. There are false allegations for all sorts of motives. And the fact that anybody should ascribe to a female, or because if it's a gender-based complaint, it's wrong to suggest that they are automatically truthful. I have railed against this concept of hashtag we believe, because I find that to be ripe for wrongful convictions. And so in our case, we rely, when we take on a case, we just don't rely on what our client says, okay? Thank you very much, client. That's great. What other evidence do you have? And we get reams of stuff. We get messages that go throughout the whole relationship. I get, you know, sometimes videos, audio recordings, all sorts of stuff, financial transactions, everything that goes to the heart of the narrative of the complainant. And we rely on these secondary sources, and sometimes we rely on a private investigator to do work for us. And we can really pinpoint demonstrative evidence that will show that somebody is lying. For example, if you bear with me for a moment, mm-hmm. I had a client, for whatever reason, loved to record everything, and then she would send images. I think she forgot about it. And then after some years, when she was not happy with my client for a number of reasons, and they were in a divorce, she accused him of various things, and he was charged. And then my client said, oh, you know, I got images of everything. So when she said that these sexual assaults occurred on these dates, I had images during that period of time and videos subsequent showing very enthusiastic consent to sexual activity. Okay. That's just one example. And I was able to not only bring that application at the beginning of the trial, but because she said other stuff during cross-examination, I then stopped cross-examination, brought a mid-trial application to admit more evidence. When I won that application, she refused to return for cross. That was a false allegation. So it's real. It's not rare. It occurs in about 2 or 3 times out of 10. And that's significant. And I think we need to be really careful. People lie. Men, women, children, people lie. And that's just what you and I deal with. We're, you know, mm-hmm. it's human nature.
Mm-hmm. What did you take? What do you make of the sort of the online, the chatter that you've been receiving? I mean,
you know what disturbed me the most?
Yeah, I want to hear that.
Okay, so there is a couple of lawyers in Toronto who really attacked me. And they didn't attack me with any type of intelligent response. It was just basically, I'm spreading myths, and I'm bad for that. One of them wrote, do better, be better. And she's an employment lawyer in Toronto in a notable, respected firm. Some other lawyer, I couldn't quite understand what her practice is, but again, was quoting me, I don't know what, some stats that she had. And then a doctor out of New Brunswick, I think, who was trying to give me stats on violence. And I'm like, yeah, okay, that's all great. But you're not answering the question. Do you accept the fact that there are false allegations? And he wouldn't deal with it. And I just got vilified. And they would use these, in my opinion, childish responses and tactics to try and get at me. And I just didn't bite to it. But what I found so troubling about it is Several were lawyers practicing in my province. Another one was a doctor.
Hmm.
Like, we have a fiduciary duty to our communities, to the practice of law or medicine, to be honest. And to deny this type of fact is ridiculous. That's what troubled me the most. You know, we're odd. People are on Twitter saying stuff that doesn't bother me because there's a lot of lunatics out there. But that's what bothered me. It was the professionals.
Tell me, so I want to circle back. I know you did commentary on, we just talked about that a second ago, on about the Heard Johnny Depp case.
I did.
I did too. Tell me your thoughts about that case, because there's a documentary out now on Netflix, which talks about the sort of the public reaction to it. 22? God, the number was insane. The number of people that were reposting the, hashtag justice for Johnny versus people that were posting things favorable to Amber Heard.
Yeah.
What was your take on that whole case, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah. So, it was a very interesting study for me psychologically, right? So you're dealing with two celebrities. Johnny Depp is a very charismatic celebrity. One of my sons is named Jack. Okay, so my two older children, Ben and Rachel, when we had a third child, I said, what do you want to name Jack? They go, oh, Jack Sparrow. Johnny Depp has something in my house.
He's sort of part of the popular culture, right? Like he has that I don't want to say it a myth, but he definitely has the aura of being part of the popular culture. I mean, he's Jack Sparrow.
He's got a charm and a pleasing way. And I think he's a great actor. I think he's a wonderful actor. And so I thought this was an interesting study because you've got two people in a toxic relationship where you've got, the immersion of alcohol and drugs, and people are not on their best behavior. And I think what it came down to was bitterness. Sheer bitterness. And I don't know really what happened, but I don't believe Amber Heard. I think she was contradicted significantly in her evidence. I think her presentation was, if I can say it this way, unpleasing. And I think it was a good caution to all of us about how you want to advance your arguments. I mean, if she says, what I was most concerned about was this was about her public statement about being abused, without naming Johnny Depp, that was the ultimate defamation issue. She's doing that for money. She's doing that for fame, for notoriety, for whatever. And I have a deep problem with that. These are things that we don't publicize cheerily for gaining some notoriety. And I thought her presentation was poor. I thought her credibility and reliability suffered significantly. At the end of the day, to be honest, I'm not sure what happened between the two of them. I don't believe her at all. I think the jury's verdict was good in the circumstances. I think they did the best they can with the evidence. And I think this was, something that was a good view into a woman who's scorned and wants to score points for other ulterior motives.
It's interesting because I watched, I did commentary for Long Crime Network during that trial, and did some local stuff on that trial as well. But Long Crime, I spent a considerable amount of time talking about the Heard Depp Heard case. One, I thought that you anticipate that in a high profile case like that the lawyering on both sides is going to be stupendous, and
it wasn't.
There was some good lawyering at moments, and then there was some other lawyering that was particularly clumsy. Might be an appropriate word.
Amateur.
But what I found interesting in that case tell me if you agree with this, is that there were a significant number of people that what it did is it reminded me that in a lot of ways, the public, our jury pools and the, you know, the groups from which they come, like there are certain people that we want to be not guilty or innocent. Like we really truly give certain people a presumption of innocence. Like if I were to say to you, who's the one person in your life that if I told you this person is accused of a crime, you would say, I don't believe it. No way. You better have like concrete proof.
A mountain of evidence.
Yes. Yeah. You better have it. And for me, it's my mother. Like that's my mother. I just, you know, I know my mom. I know that's that people would say, come on.
Your mom is, I get it. 100%.
My mother. And there are other people that
I would say my wife.
Okay. There are other people like that. There are other people that I know in my life that I would say, no way. You had better have more than one witness. That witness better be unimpeachable, unassailable. You better have correct, right? Like, you know, people were cheering Michael Jackson post, right? I mean,
yeah.
And, you know, like, whatever happened there, I mean, you know what I mean? And I wasn't there, but they wanted him to be not guilty, right? People right. wanted him to be not guilty.
Yeah, so between Amber Heard and Johnny Depp, who do you like more?
Johnny Depp.
There you go. I mean, that's your winner.
I thought that he came across, and I evaluated them as witnesses, as I'm sure you did. Yes. I thought he came across like somebody who was trying to he owned more of the bad stuff that was put to him. Like he owned more of it when questions were put to him, which gives him to me that gives him credibility, as opposed to
absolutely.
I thought Amber Heard would try to deflect and move about all over the place. So all right, so tell me a couple of things if you don't mind. Like who would you consider to be like, well, let me back up. What would you consider to be your cross-examination style?
You know, my cross-examination style is really intellectual. I'm based on, you know, an intelligent cross-examination that's probing and assertive. I think that's the way to try and describe it. I even till today, you know, 31 years, my object is I draft out everything. I write it out. I have lines everywhere. I go off script, of course, when I do my cross, but it's, you know, it's like a chess game. Mm-hmm. So I want to have an intellectual cross-examination where I can move the complainant or the witness in a place where I need them to be. I'm not bombastic. I have humor. But, you know, the idea is to be intellectual, to move them to where I want to be so everybody understands.
Who is considered in, other than you, who is considered in Canada or in Ontario to be like, you know, the greatest, you know, we always refer to Darrow here, you know, Clarence Darrow, like the grandfather of criminal defense advocacy in the United States. So who would you consider, who is that person in Canada?
So I'm only going to speak in my era. So over my 30, 31 years. So because there are others before that time, like J.J. Robinette and others who are really, I understood, quite fantastic. But to me, John Rosen, who was Mr. Murder, was an outstanding cross-examiner. John McMahon, as a Crown attorney, was an outstanding cross-examiner. I think Marie Hennin in my era, now she's got a vibrant practice here. She's a very good cross-examiner. I have to say we have a very good defense bar here where we have some really good cross-examining people. Passed away is Jack Pinkowski. I mean, Jack was known for his first question. It was like, it was a question that would put the complainant or the witness on their heels, whether it was a cop or whoever. And Jack was fucking great at the first question. I'm sorry, Ezra. He was great at the first question. He was amazing. But I've had the pleasure of really working with some people who had some real panache when they cross-examined. We've lost so many people over the last decade who've sadly passed away. But I think, you know, really, John Rosen, Jack Pinkovsky, Eddie Greenspan, Brian Greenspan, who's with us, thank God, and got a robust practice. Marie Hennen, I think, is outstanding. There are a lot of good cross-examiners here because we've got a lot of work and they really work hard. They really awesome. Work hard.
If you had to pick one person that you would want to cross-examine, dead or alive, like who would
that
it be?
I would want to cross-examine for
that
me.
You want to cross-examine for you, yes.
If I was an accused?
No, just right now. If you said to me, you know what? I want a shot at that person. Like Joe Neuberger, I want to take my shot at that person. I know I could destroy that person.
I want to cross-examine Amber Heard. I want to cross-examine Amber Heard, and I'm not going to and I'm not going to be like that very nice lady who cross-examined her. I will be totally different. I want Amber Heard in my I want her.
Okay. I love it. That's a first. I love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. All right, this has been an awesome conversation with you. I'm so glad you joined me on the
podcast. So delighted you reached out. I mean,
oh, it's been
I'd
fantastic.
Love that we can connect. I mean, I'd love fantastic. More cross stuff with the United States. I absolutely love this. So thank you.
Oh, it's fantastic. Tell me, because I know people like to follow and subscribe and try to, you know, track you down and track our guests down. Let's run through your social media profile, your website, how people can reach you. So start at the top. Name of your firm is?
Thank you. So it's Neuberger & Partners, LLP. Our website is www.nrlawyers.com. We have a podcast with Diana Davison, who's the savant, which I say runs the non-for-profit organization. So that's Not On Record podcast on YouTube and everywhere else you can find a podcast. And we also have a newsletter, a sex assault newsletter, which is published bi-monthly, which is on our website. So if you really want to reach us, just go to the website at www.nrlawyers.com or go to our podcast, Not On Record, on YouTube.
And just for anybody listening, I had no idea that his website was, this is totally by coincidence, are my two initials, NR Lawyers. I had no clue that it was nrlawyers.com. But so this has been an amazing conversation. You know how to reach the man. If you're in trouble or you just want to learn more about what's going on in Ontario or about the legal system, or if you happen to have been in Toronto and you did something you shouldn't have, or think you're going to be accused of doing something that you didn't do, this is the man to reach out to. Joe Neuberger, thank you so much for joining me on the Killer Cross-Examination podcast. It's been fantastic. This is Neil Rockhine. Welcome to another edition of the Killer Cross-Examination podcast. You can find us everywhere. Podcasts are to be heard or downloaded. You can find us on YouTube. We're there to be found. And again, I'm so glad that Joe, you joined us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Neil.